Hello, I'm Luke Clancy, and you're welcome to the Culture File Weekly, the audio equivalent of downing your drink in one big swig. And this week, the pot is filled with the belated vindication of painter Frank Bowling, the belated vilification of the Bauhaus, as well as Owen Nolan on the neat trick of having ideas. But we begin this weekly with the ultimate bank job. Artist and filmmaker team of Hilary Powell and Dan Edelstein have upcycled a disused high street bank in East London to create art and abolish debt. Powell and Edelstein's Hoe Street Central Bank, HSCB for short, has printed currency and issued bonds, using the proceeds to buy up delinquent debts in the borough around them, as well as fund enterprises such as food banks and homeless outreach. Culturefile met Hilary Powell and Dan Edelstein for some lessons in dismantling the creditocracy.
We're at Hoe Street Central Bank on a busy Hoe Street in Walthamstow in northeast London.
Yep, we're outside on a slushy, rain-swept street on the wettest day so far of the year, somewhere in June, about the 10th of June.
And this is actually a bank. It says HSCB Rebel Bank on the door in a nice official bronze plaque.
A budget bronze plaque, but yeah, we've just been dubbed the Rebel Bank. But this, and that's what we've been doing in here, kind of rebel banking, alternative banking, printing money for buying up and exploding debt. But this building actually was a bank. It was a co-op bank from the 1980s, and before that a Midland bank, so it has that banking heritage.
So inside it, you say a bank, but it looks almost like a printing works. There's washing lines of freshly minted something hanging from the walls.
Yeah, well, when we first moved in, it was very, like, you know, kind of bland, contemporary, down-at-heel kind of bank with carpet tiles and suspended ceilings. So over the year, well, we straight away painted it this two-tone green and got in the old desks and the banker's lamps and filing cabinets. So we were going for more vintage bank. And slowly we've revealed more of its actual history before, you know, the boxing in of the 80s when everything was suddenly just boxed in for no reason. So we found the old vault and cupboards in the walls and kind of remnants of that former history. So we wanted to draw out that history. And yeah, it's become a print workshop and a kind of space for making and talking and thinking about economics and money.
What's that?
That's just me boinging some of these metal panels from the van, which are hanging up in the main space with my knuckles.
So at the back of the bank is the most non-bank element of things, which is a sort of suspended scrapyard.
That's the remnants of the gold Ford Transit van, which we blew up about 10 days, 20 days? Oh, no, 2 weeks ago, was it? Yeah. Was it 2 weeks ago? Yeah, it seems longer ago. But yeah, we blew it up, and the idea was that that was the climax of the feature film that we're making, which is called Bank Job, which we've tried to make in the genre of a kind of heist film. And although it's a documentary, we wondered if we could create something that was as seat of your pants as a kind of Ocean's 11 or something like that. So we wanted to have an explosion in the middle of our film. So we, well, not in the middle, at the climax of our film. So we, well, Hilary painted this van gold. And we worked with a team of explosives experts, and we put a bomb in it and blew it up, basically. And the idea was that we were abolishing £1.2 million worth of local high-interest debt from the area where we're now standing, in Walthamstow and Leighton and those types of areas. It's not a very visual thing to actually cancel debt. It's sort of file save on the spreadsheet, you know, now those things. So we wanted to try and find a way of visualising it and bringing attention and turning it into a kind of a national conversation about the way our economy currently works and the kind of debt-fueled model of economics, which we're absolutely embroiled in, you know, as a country.
As well as printing money, which in itself, banknotes The proceeds from that went to buy up the 1.2 million of local debt and help the local causes that are pictured on the banknotes. We then moved on to printing bonds, which was a way of financing the explosion, paper bonds that are artworks. But the return on investment for people who've supported the project in that way is a coin made out of this van. So it's a big kind of material experiment in transforming value, really. So now we're in this phase of turning the metal of the van that we exploded full of debt into coins that are the return for bondholders, and other people are now interested in buying them, but we need to make them.
So, well, you've got enough equipment to do that here.
Yeah. The printing machines at the front, they're letterpress and four blocking, and we've done screen printing. And in the back now, we've got two fly press that will punch and strike the coins. And in July, we're working with London Sculpture Workshop to cast any aluminium and cast iron from the engines to make some more chunky coins. So it's all go.
I was the initial researcher on the project. I'm a filmmaker, and I became interested in a group called Strike Debt in America, who were buying up and abolishing millions of dollars worth of student and medical debt. I met with members of Strike Debt, and on my way there, I read what they call their movement literature. And one of the writers was Professor Andrew Ross from New York University, who wrote a book called Creditocracy and the Case for Debt Refusal, in which he argued that debt was being wrapped around access to the basic social goods, you know, such as healthcare, education, housing. And he was saying that basically since the 1970s, the advent of neoliberalism, we were living more and more under the rule of creditocrats. He argued that even the year after the 2008 crisis, the major banks in America and even in Europe had never been so profitable. That how was it that 1 year, 2 years after a financial crisis, their balance sheets had leapt even bigger?
This is the bank manager's office. And, well, I'm not the bank, you know, I'm the governor, so bank manager is not quite right, but this was the co-op bank manager's office. So lots of people who come in remember being called into here when it was a bank. But now it's the governor, and it's a more optimistic space, I hope.
And this is the desk of the head of explosives at the bank, and that's me. But it's a less glamorous type of job, but it's totally fine. I'm happy with that title. I didn't know anything about economics really at all, but I was beginning to see that my understanding of what money is and also, you know, the role of banks in our economy was, you know, needed to be massively transformed, and it just changed the way I saw things. I felt a bit like the character in that film, They Live. Don't know if you've seen that one, but he put on a pair of glasses, and all of a sudden he could see that the people around him that he thought were just normal people were aliens. And, you know, it was that type of, like, radical transformation of the way I could view the world and the economy and everything around me. And I guess up to a point, you know, I became a sort of radical exponent of debt abolition, and I wanted to try and bring that movement across to Britain.
To tackle that kind of big story of money and debt and those abstract ideas, it took a while to work out how to frame a story, but we realised by starting where we lived and seeing if Walthamstow was a creditocracy and building those connections with our community, that would help us look at the bigger picture of treating it as a kind of microcosm. For us, it was a way of looking in our home territory. So it's become all-encompassing because the people on the banknotes are like our children's head teacher. We raised 40,000, and 20,000 of that was used to buy the debt, but 20,000 was split equally between giving it to these four local causes. Oh, yes, so over here, we've got them on the walls now, so people can kind of get a potted history of what's been going on here, because we're kind of building up the layers of the project. But in March 2018, we printed these banknotes. We did a £1 note, but we did fives, tens, twenties and fifties. And the fives in this kind of orangey colour feature Gary, who runs the local food bank, Syra and her family, who run a homeless kitchen called Plates for Yuval Sufa, Steve and Josh, who run the Soul Project, which is a local youth project doing this incredibly kind of key work of keeping people out of kind of gangs and getting positive role models. And they lost their building recently to luxury flats. And Tracy is our children's local primary school head teacher, who are suffering more severely from the school cuts because they are such a small school. So like subject teaching assistants have to go, and creative subjects are being axed, as is happening all across the country because of the austerity measures. So we felt we wanted them on our banknotes because, rather than the Queen or famous figures from British history, because we felt they were dealing directly with the fallout of the current unjust economic system. So when we sold these, £5 sterling could get you 5 Garys or 5 Syrahs. Their stories are so kind of revealing of the current system, like why is food bank usage going up in and the homeless kitchen needing to cater for more and more people in what is meant to be one of the richest, you know, economies in the world. Something's obviously going a bit awry, and so their stories reveal that.
Hilary Powell and Dan Edelstein of HSCB there in Walthamstow at the heart of London's first ever Borough of Culture. True fact. Now, in its short life, the German Uber Art School, the Bauhaus, created a legacy that we can detect all over our lives and ideas, not only in the fields of art and design, but in social practice. But how selective are we about what we choose to celebrate from the Bauhaus, and what parts of its legacy have we found it convenient to forget? Earlier this year, Culturefile reported from the Bauhaus Effects Art and Design Conference in Dublin, which looked at some of the aftershocks of the school, but some inconvenient truths remain. Which is why Culturefile's Anya Gallagher met with David Crowley, head of the School of Visual Culture at NCAD, and Francis Housel, also lecturer at NCAD, to discuss how even the walls of this liberal institution were not impervious to national socialism.
There's a great thing about the art school, which is that in classes I hold, you can have discussions about feminism or about politics or about the environment, as well as having discussions about what you can do with materials. And I think you wouldn't necessarily be having those conversations in other places in the university. The other great thing about the art school is that because people don't really know what you do there, they haven't quite yet worked out a way of controlling it. So it's still a kind of a space of freedom. You saw that in the Bauhaus, right? There was lots of kind of crazy things going on at the Bauhaus. It was one of the reasons why the authorities in the 1930s were kind of worried about it. You know, it was closed down by the Nazi Party. Although the Bauhaus does have a quite complicated relationship with the Nazi Party.
My name is Francis Hussle, and I work at the National College of Art and Design in Dublin, where I work in the Visual Culture School.
But there's definitely a thing to be said about the Bauhaus, that there isn't one Bauhaus, and that how one reads the legacy of the Bauhaus probably reflects one's own commitments now, whether one's interested in kind of a particular style or a particular kind of ideology. The people who are involved in the Bauhaus were a complex and complicated group of people, and it's not quite so simple to say that they were universally opposed to the rise of the Nazis, for example. There was kind of areas of complicity.
My name is David Crowley, and I'm an architectural historian who's got an interest in the 20s and the 30s. The most provocative and quite challenging element of this history is that we know that one of the architects who designed Auschwitz-Birkenau was Bauhaus trained, and that in a way, a school which had been so committed to a machine aesthetic, to trying to think about modernity as this new machine age, this architect was involved in this machinic death, this system of mass death. And of course, the terrible tragedy in that is a number of Bauhaus artists and designers were killed there. So we have this very dark history, which I don't think in any sense the Bauhaus is responsible for. It didn't produce this attitude, but it shows the complexity, I think, of Germany in the 1930s, and the fact that there were 1,200 students at the Bauhaus, and anybody who lived in Central Europe through the course of that history would have been pulled to the left and to the right. The end of the Bauhaus is often told as an event really triggered by an aggressive Nazi regime in formation. So the local authorities in Dessau in 1932 forced the Bauhaus out of its famous building, you know, this building which is so iconic. And this is really the beginning of the Bauhaus as a kind of victim of history. That's true. But the interesting thing is that some of the Bauhaus architects and designers were quite attracted, or perhaps over-attracted to the kind of opportunities that a powerful authoritarian regime could offer an architect and designer. So the third director of the Bauhaus, Mies van der Rohe, it looks like he spent a bit of time courting the authorities after Hitler came to power in 1933. He signed a declaration in support of the regime. And we don't have full sets of drawings, but it looks like the work he was trying to do at that stage even looks quite like Nazi architecture. It's much more monumental, symmetrical. There's even a sketch that has a design for a Nazi pavilion that was to be displayed in Brussels at an exhibition in 1935. So the story of the victimhood of the Bauhaus in recent years has been balanced by also this sort of interest in, on the part of some Bauhaus architects and designers, to find opportunities. Lots of the Bauhausler, they left Germany, but Herbert Bayer, wonderful graphic designer, he stayed, and he stayed for a number of years, and he also received commissions to design Nazi propaganda. And he used a lot of his modernist skills and designs to do this. And what's paradoxical is that he was married to a Jewish woman at the time, and I think he was struggling. You know, he needed opportunities to work, and we shouldn't sit in judgment who would want to live through the 1930s in Germany. But in the end, he's triggered to leave because he finds one of his early paintings on display in a famous exhibition called the Degenerate Art Exhibition, where the Nazis have put modern art up on the walls to ridicule it. And that's the trigger for him to go off to the United States and then have a very successful career. So not necessarily somebody who had an easy 1930s, but it shows the quandaries of being a designer at that time. I think the Bauhaus history has been written by people who are very strongly connected to the Bauhaus. So right from the beginning in the 1930s, Walter Gropius, the director, is quite interested in narrating the history of the Bauhaus, so he has his own vision. And then Bauhaus scholars are often great fans of their subject, and why not? This is a real center of genius and talent. But I think in a way that's kind of created a more a defensive attitude. And in fact, my professor when I was a student was a great Bauhaus scholar. She was a really significant figure. And when she heard the story that I've just said about Auschwitz, I think she was really devastated by it.
NCAD's David Crowley there, and the reporter was Anya Gallagher. The first solo exhibition of Frank Bowling's paintings in Ireland last summer came late in the career of an artist who graduated from London's Royal College of Art the same year as David Hockney, that's 1962, and had his first solo exhibition in London the same year. But Bowling's first major retrospective in Britain comes even later, with Tate Britain's show just opened to general and overdue acclaim. This time we hear again from Anna Schneider, a Bowling specialist who took Culturefile on a stroll through the life and work of a painter whose time has finally and undeniably come, while he's happily still around to enjoy it.
His paintings, they're just incredibly beautiful and really allowed to delve into this colour and richness of life, and you really feel that he has put so much life and energy into them, and it's just a visual pleasure. So it is just wonderful to be in a space with his paintings and see this, the painterly qualities, the colors, the light. Frank Bowling came to London from Guyana, at that time still British Guyana, in 1953. He then, after some sort of detours, got really interested in painting and wanted to study. And after a few, attempts to enter the Royal College, he then also managed in 59. It's very interesting to look at the beginning of his career, where in which he did figurative expressionist work, from which he then totally shifts away when he moves to New York in 1967. He works with stencils and silkscreen techniques and introduces the map like other painters at that time, like, for example, Larry Rivers, Jasper Jones. I mean, the map was certainly a motif that many artists dealt with. But Frank Bowling really found his own way to deal with this formal, but at the same time, subject-based element, and really trying to find his position in the art world and being, on the one hand, from Guyana, so socialized with an education in England, in London, and then going back to the Americas, but in New York, of course, being considered more of a black artist. Frank, maybe as an outsider, so not being American, not being from New York, was able to comment in a more distanced way, because he was neither a white artist nor he was a black American artist. So he was, in a way, a bit distanced from, you know, he wasn't in the midst of it, so he could comment on it in a different way. He lived a very cosmopolitan life in the sense that he was moving, going back from London and New York constantly. He's really kind of the incarnation or the embodiment of that sort of double consciousness, or even maybe triangular consciousness.
Frank Bowling specialist Anna Schneider on the life and works of Frank Bowling. Frank Bowling's UK retrospective runs at the Tate Britain in London until the end of August. And finally this weekly, our favourite brand wrangler, Owen Nolan, has had an idea. Several of them, in fact. But is our idea of ideas a good one? Owen has a slightly unreasonable point of view.
One of the more testing things about having an idea is that sometimes you don't know if you've definitely had one or not. No matter how long the gestation, not all ideas are like hen's eggs sitting indisputably before you in the straw. But let's start at the beginning, before the egg or non-egg. There are ideas that people hunt for and ideas that hunt for people. Individuals look for ideas and so do groups of people working together. While many different kinds of places seek ideas, few do so as tangibly or to so short a deadline as an ad agency. Government think tanks, tech giants, scientists, people who have recently been made redundant, detectives, venture capitalists, artists, aspiring entrepreneurs, all may seek ideas. Yet, unlike an ad agency, few have someone coming in on Tuesday to see a presentation of fresh thoughts. And when those people do come in, they'll expect to see feasible and imaginative ideas laid before them like a wonderful carpet, which they scrutinise closely, occasionally with glee or at least some enthusiasm. Too often they receive the presentation with a very real, if veiled, threat of taking their business elsewhere if they don't like what they see. Going back to eggs for a moment, you'll probably have heard the expression that while the hen is involved in your breakfast, the pig is committed to it. Equally, while the client is involved in the idea, the agency is committed to it. So how does an idea come about in the first place? Hunting for ideas is not a mystical process, but it is a process. And the first essential part of that process is the brief. Anybody looking for an idea for anything needs a brief. Fundamentally, although the nature of ideas and the very definition of an idea may change depending on the discipline or industry, the brief will be the beacon that lights the way to developing an idea and is also the touchstone by which the newly formed idea can be assayed. The brief defines the task and describes what is sought. Of course, some ideas are found during the search for other different ideas. Viagra was originally developed as a treatment for heart-related chest pain. The inventor of the video doorbell named Ring, recently sold to Amazon, was trying to invent something for horticultural use in his garage when he realized he couldn't hear his doorbell while working in the garage. So he devised a solution that he sold 6 years later for $1 billion. Then there was the tale of King Gillette, founder of the Gillette Razor Company. Legend had it that as his 40th birthday approached, he was so desperate to invent something that would make money, he locked himself for 3 days in his small apartment, well stocked with food and paper and drawing materials, and kept himself awake with coffee, feverishly pursuing that elusive killer idea. After 3 days, he had nothing. He had failed. Defeated, he decided he should wash and shave, which was when he had his eureka moment, realizing that every morning, everywhere, men were frustrated by their blunt, cutthroat razors and having to sharpen them on a leather strop. Not much of that is true, of course, but there was one essential fact that guided Gillette. He had worked as a salesman for the Crown Cork and Seal Company, which made bottle tops. His boss, knowing Gillette's desire to invent, advised him to invent something that people use every day and throw away. Gillette had a lot of other ideas and would go on to imagine an America where everyone lived in a single giant rectangular city called Metropolis, which would be electrically powered by Niagara Falls and have buildings made of porcelain, while all the needs of the citizens were met by one giant corporation of which everyone was an owner. But back to Gillette's drive to come up with an idea for something that people use every day, discard, and, here's the important bit, replace. That was essentially King Gillette's brief to himself, and when he hit upon the idea of developing the stamped razor blade that would have a short life, he knew he had an idea, arguably one of the best a man can get. The brief will guide the ingredients that go into the idea and will also act as a template to check the output against. It's the litmus test, the acid test, containing all the criteria the idea must meet. If you ask yourself to come up with ideas occasionally or on a regular basis, it can be important to ponder where ideas come from. It's tempting to view the process as almost supernatural, and the concepts being as rare as hen's teeth. Not so. A far better way is to think of the creative process as governed by physical laws that are only slightly beyond our ken. Ideas aren't quite at our beck and call, but reach and you will find them. Search often and you'll find often. They're not unicorns so much as deer. A journalist once asked prolific singer and songwriter Tom Waits if he was worried about running out of ideas for songs. "Are you kidding?" replied Waits. "It's raining songs. I just can't find enough pots and pans to catch them in."
Owen Nolan's slightly unreasonable point of view, bringing to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll have more well-briefed ideation next Friday, just after 7, here on RTE Lyric FM. Until then, bye now.